So I think we can start then. There are two things that I should clarify. First, I realized that the rule that I gave following Book of Payments, several early references for left introduction rule for this junction, was mistaken in all of these references. And I only realize it now when I try to prove for myself soundness result that we want to do today with respect to this resource monologues that I showed last time. I started, and of course I got stuck in the clouds for the left disjunction, and I started to look for it, then I realized, I found out something that I read long ago, only in one paper from 2005 there is a small footnote saying that Pym made, by paper coupled by Pym himself, that he made a mistake in this book, but he forgot to edit it before the book went to print. The mistake was copied in several papers, and now they can give the proper form of that rule. So, the left, funnily enough, what he says there is that the left rule for, that there are no consequences of that mistake. So this is disingenuous for me, because either this rule is sound or not. I realized it only when I was comparing them to last time, so I didn't have time to try to find a counterexample. But just for...
all the errors in the erratum are without known consequences, strangely.
Sorry?
All the errors in the erratum are without known consequences.
Errors in what?
In the erratum? I mean, were you not referring to the erratum to Pym's book?
Yes. So you see, also mentioned the erratum that he gave wrong definition for the long left disjunction. Have you seen it? I didn't check the erratum.
No, I didn't check that. I mean, there's lots of errors in it regarding the completeness proof, apparently.
Yeah. So the left disjunction rule that we can use is actually then much simpler. In fact, this is exactly the rule that we derived. I think. Let me double check if this is the rule that we derived. Left side. Yes, this is the rule that we derived for this junction. So now this is not a derived rule, but from now on we have to call this rule simply the rule for left disjunction. So just for write this in words, this is from now on, or this is, okay. The one given in the other lectures, following Pym's book and other early references, well, I don't want to claim that this is not sound, not having a counterexample, but it is mistaken. It's actually a good question if, regardless of the statement that this is without known consequences, we can find that an example of derivation which shouldn't be even sound with respect to our intended semantics. But. Okay, so this is one thing, and the other thing was pertaining to the definition of our resource monoids, the partial, the proper way of defining partial the associativity law for partial operations. We had some discussion during the last lecture about this. I checked how it is set actually in the reference. In some of the references, it is completely glossed over. So it just says that it's a natural definition or whatever. And in some of the references, I was able to find an explicit definition, and it indeed seems to postulate less than what was postulated last time. So correction number two. Definition of partial pre-order resource monoids. Clause for associativity. So what was stated, at least in the in one of the papers by Galimsh and co-authors, was simply that if M N times O is defined, then M N times O is equal to M times N O. But actually, if you look at this, then this thing defined must mean that this thing is defined in particular. So we could as well state that this thing has to be defined, and then we could derive as a consequence in particular, if this thing is defined, then this thing must be defined as well. Right? It doesn't make sense otherwise to speak about times O otherwise. So in the end, it seems to me that all those definitions that one can reasonably write are really defining one and the same thing. But if we need one fixed definition, then probably it's best to stick to the definition that we see in explicitly in some of the references.
This definition, couldn't it be that in this equation the right hand side is defined and the left hand isn't?
No, this is a commutative.
Okay.
Yeah. This is so. Indeed, we are using the fact that our resource monoids are commutative ones, and just like in the linear case, we never dealt in fact with the situation where our operations were not commutative. It is sometimes considered. It is, and this is really what this thing called full Lambert calculus that I was telling you about when introducing the idea of substructural logic is all about. And for some applications, for example, in linguistics, I think that I even mentioned at that time, it's not even a good thing to insist that this multiplicative conjunction or fusion or whatever it is always totally defined. Right, so we had a bunch of structure, those partial pre-order resource monoids, total pre-order resource monoids, partial discrete resource monoids, and total discrete resource monoids. And now we are going to see some of them in real life. So, of course, the trivial thing to do is to pick any commutative monoid at all and impose them in the discrete order. Then all the other clauses in the definition would be trivially satisfied. Maybe let's start with it. And, standard mathematical, because of course we will see some other example of monoids in what follows. But for the time being, let's make clear that here I mean integers, naturals, rationals, reals, commutative one, of course. With the discrete order. In fact, in all those guys come equipped with natural total order and the monoid operation. Well, if this is addition with multiplication, when you have negative numbers, one has to be careful, but not to the reverse order. But at least, if you consider, let's say, natural numbers, positive reals, positive rationals, then addition would, moreover, satisfy this condition, which we called. Bifunctionality or simply monotonicity or generalized monotonicity, monotonicity in both arguments. So that would be an example of total discrete resource monoid. But especially in case of natural numbers with addition, they appear anyway with. In the more computer science setting, as so-called cost model. Actually, I'm not sure if people consider those cost models together with standard order or as unordered discrete ones. Sorry, the cost model is with the order. So this is an example of what I was calling total pre-order, total partial order in some sense. Right? But of course, this is not particularly exciting. We would like to see some of the examples which are meaningful from. Well, this is also meaningful from a computer science point of view, but something closer to this resource interpretation. And now we are going to walk through a sequence of examples that are making this idea closer and closer to life. So first, let us consider arbitrary set X, and maybe actually let's give a model, to, give a name to this thing. So this would be primitive resource allocation and the allocation, or basic. So we pick arbitrary set X. And we consider the collection of all its finite subsets, but with ordinary union, but with some restriction. Just for reminder, although I think that you saw this notation somewhere before, this is the collection of finite subsets of X. So let us consider this collection of finite subset of X as the domain of our monoid. This slightly modified union, or this union, or this union also has to be a bit careful with this word, but union operation, and with empty set as the union of our partial monoid, where this thing is simply X plus Y x plus y, sorry, if y, x times y is, if x and y are disjoint and it's undefined otherwise. And then there are two ways of turning into our resource monoid, one with partial order, with non-degenerate or non-discrete partial order, the other one with discrete order. Of course, to obtain PDRM, take inclusion sorry, take discrete order. And in to obtain PPRM, we have to take inclusion, of course, but one has to be now slightly careful, namely that this condition of bifunctionality as defined for partial monoids is satisfied. We need to possets. And recall that this had to do something with things that are not only with the monoid operation preserving the order in both coordinates, although this was of course the most important thing, but also with the finiteness. So in other words, we have to notice, but fortunately for this example this is very trivial and it won't be much difficult for another example that we want to consider today, that whenever x is contained in x prime and y is contained in x prime and x plus y prime is defined, then x plus y is also defined and it's contained here. So this inclusion is of course trivial by standard properties of inclusion, but fortunately this is also immediate, because if those two larger guys are disjoint, then the two smaller guys have to be disjoint as well. Is fine. And yeah, the second example is already the example, let's say, the most important motivational one. Maybe I should have pushed it to the very end to build up suspense or tension. But okay, let's. Separation model. What are the other words that one can use? Of course, this is also a model of resource allocation and the allocation, but we have something more here to model. We can also do pointer aliasing and update. We probably won't have time to discuss actual programming. Well, not programming. Horror-like languages where you have some very basic programming features. And the original language of bunch implication only serves as the language of assertions for that language. But This is intended model for all toy programming languages built in this world of BI and separation logic. So we have two sets. One is the set of locations, and another model, and another set is the set of record values. And in order to make it concrete, we can, well, you see all sorts of things in the literature, but perhaps the most standard thing is first to define the set of basic values. Let's say that our intended values that we operate on in our programming language are integers. And then we have also the set of locations. Locations can be values themselves. And the nil pointer. So these things are really like addresses in memory. And then the record values are defined using our values as the set of pairs consisting of a value and location plus nil. Well, this is still a very restricted model because this really means that what we have here is just what we saw last time. You remember this memory model where you had two cell pointers, where you had two cells consisting of two compartments, where the first compartment of the cell was value itself, in this case either an integer or some other pointer, and the other thing was pointing to the next element in the list. So a more general definition would only insist that this guy is somehow maybe not even included in set theoretical sense, but there can, for example, that can be that is simply a projection from the set of record values to here. If you have, for example, trees defined as cells with two pointers. Maybe let's just mention it. There is a projection function, possibly more than one, as in this case. Well, as I said, one can see also the definition, especially Jordan Reynolds, the founding father of separation logic, changed his mind over the last decade of his life, let's say. How it should be defined. Anyway, we can stick, for precision, we can stick to this being our definite setup. And then, however one wants to define this set of locations and the set of record values, we say then that the heap model, they call those guys heaps, yes. We could, for clarity, add superscript referring to the concrete set of locations and record values that we have, is the set of finite partial functions from locations to record values. So we always have, maybe heaplets, this would be a better name, but actually in real life, in real computer, the whole heap would be always a partial a finite function too. But those things are not necessarily intended to be thought of as I told you already in the introductory lecture, as a total heap. Quite often one wants to reason in terms of heap fragments, which can be composed or not. And then therefore, we could pose a definition which is surprisingly similar to this one. Namely, we will define our monoid structure on heaplets using again this operation, more or less. But now, instead of saying that heaplets themselves have to be disjoint, we replace this part by their domains, of course. So. And this would be an ordinary set theoretical sum if you identify a partial function with its graph, if the domain of the first heaplet is disjoint with the domain of the second heaplet, and it's undefined otherwise. So the monoid structure is again, maybe we can write it now, M, but this time we can even write parameters for clarity, the set of our heaplets, with the definition, with the operation just defined as monoid, and with the empty heaplet again, so the heaplet with empty domain as the monoid unit. And just like before, we could either take the discrete order, and then we would obtain PDLM. Sorry, yeah. And then the other option, which is, this is the most standard solution, by the way. This is what is mostly considered. But there is also, again, more intuitionistic option. You will see, if not during this lecture, then maybe during the House of Gaber, why I'm using the word intuitionistic now. So there is also intuitionistic option of taking inclusion order, this time, of course, again, on domains. But actually, no, sorry, not just on heaps and on heaplets themselves. Verification of bifunctionality. Same as in the above example. So these are probably the most standard models from the point of view of computer science, well, at least the area of computer science for which separation logic was invented in the first place. But it would be quite incomplete if I didn't mention at least one more example slightly different in spirit. And this will be an example of trees. Trees as they function, let's say, in the XML world, in some structured databases. Which, and this example is also doing more justice to the word spatial that is often popping up, for example, in the name of, in the alternative name of multiplicative conjunction or fusion as spatial conjunction or separating conjunction. So, which number are we in? It's number 3, I think, because I started numbering from 0. So it's in the 4th example. Well, some structured databases sound a bit pompous, but what were the other names to use? Semi-structured data, maybe, but it's slightly less pretentious. So we consider a finite set or a fixed set of labels. And I'm going to define trees by, or rather, forests. The word being used most often in the literature is trees, but as you see, what is really being defined are forests, in fact. And then, again, tree or a forest can be empty. It can be two trees put next to each other, so this is the beginning of a forest. Or one can take an existing forest and give it a root to turn it into a tree, where A belongs to the set of labels. So let's say that what would be a nice set of labels here. Well, let's stick to dummy ones because I don't want to suggest too much with concrete names. So let's say that indeed our set of labels is just A and B, and then we have A, B itself, or the empty tree as a tree. Then we have a forest A, B. Then we have A, B. One has to, again, quotient because we want things to be commutative all the time. So here you see already an example where commutativity is not as natural as it would be in the previous examples. One has to quotient this relation modulo commutativity, which means that our trees are not sibling order. And as you know from XML, this is not exactly what is being assumed, let's say, in X power X squared. There you have a fixed order between siblings. And indeed, it would make sense to consider generalized by implication logics. There are some reactants towards in the literature where the spatial conjunction is not commutative. But in order to stick with our general definition, we don't care in which order trees are put in the forest. So this is the same thing really as B times A. We will write this explicitly soon. And then we can write this thing as, and so on and so on. So what we are really talking about is, maybe let's write one below the other. This is a syntactic representation of such a tree. This is a syntactic representation of such a tree. And as I said, the children are permutable. They are twins. They have no age differences in seniority between them. So hopefully it's clear how to term arbitrary three. Maybe let's make clear that those three do not always have to be binary into such a syntactic description. So here we have B times B, this level. Then this guy is a three of the form B times BB. This is In order to be really precise, I should have kept writing those zeros everywhere. But as you see, this is really messing up the syntax and leads to significant overhead. So this thing at the lowermost level would be zero, B zero. This would be B0, this is A0, and this is A0. And then this thing is A times B times B0, B0 times A0 times A0. It's good hardware. There are even some LaTeX, probably a bit obsolete, packages for drawing trees in LaTeX, which work with similar syntax. Of course, this can be made more sophisticated if you want the data, for example, the data stored in those trees towards instruction. But let's stick to this as our most primitive example of what trees and forests are. And let me write explicitly what I said before, that we caution this modular commutativity. So, we consider the free syntactic monoid modulo commutativity. Is it clear what a free monoid is? Who has seen the notion of free monoid? Who has vaguely heard or has some idea what it is, but wouldn't really dare to raise the hand for full yes? Who is completely in the dark what it means? Ouch. Okay, so when you, I don't want to start defining now what free structure in algebra is, because I wanted to
think quickly what a free commutative monoid over a generator set is.
Sorry?
One can say rather quickly what the free commutative monoid over a set of generators is.
Well, so the free monoid is just a set of words.
Yeah, the commutative one is the set of
words modulo commutativity, but you know.
X.
Sorry?
Multisets.
Multisets, yes. Okay, so if you don't know the word, just stick with this as the example. And then again, we could turn this basic structure into several different instances of our PDRMs, TDRMs, and so on and so on. So, monoid structure. Well, actually, even with respect to monoid structure, we have two choices. We could either decide to make it total, the way it is defined here, or say that. Is it really better?
Yeah, I think it should be okay as long as the blackboard light stays on. Is the blackboard light on?
Yes. Whatever. So there are two choices to make regarding this operation as well. One is the one to keep it total is the one more commonly made. But one can also do what is often considered in XML world and consider trees with unique labeling. And then say that this operation will be undefined if there are some labels occurring in both of these trees. So we could turn this example into total monoid or partial monoid, as we please. And we could also, again, stick to the discrete order. So we could obtain either an example of TDRM or PDRM, or we could, again, impose inclusion order on trees. So the order in which, for example, this tree is a subtree of this one.
So you consider vortices over which base set?
We start with a fixed set of labels.
So you consider multisets of labels. So you said we were going to consider the free monoid modular commutator.
Well, there is more structure to it than just a monoid structure, because we also have this tree forming operation, right?
Yeah.
Maybe that's right explicitly what I'm getting at. So. So first of all, let us call the set of all these expressions modulo commutativity as the domain of this monoid. Or simply the set of all expressions defined by the above grammar. Modulo equivalence, modulo commutativity. Oh, of course.
And what is zero meant to be neutral, or is n?
Actually, of course, if you form, if you add zero to any tree in this way, you don't modify it. So, modulo monoid laws. Commutative monoid laws for
Simon. So zero is neutral with respect to times.
Yes. Oh Lord. Yeah, but would you really denote the MP3 as 1? Or would you really denote this operation as plus? I don't like either solution. Maybe we can write the empty thing like this.
Yeah, maybe.
It's still unsatisfying, but...
it sort of matches the use of empty index n for a neutral element, which looks just as weird, basically.
The notation I took was in papers by people like Cardelli and Gordon, and also in the possible world models paper. I think they were using zero for the MP for us, but anyway, it doesn't matter. You are right that this is not, that this is somehow confusing choice. And then if S is a subtree of T. So discrete order is total discrete resource monoid is a total partially ordered resource monoid, and then what I was saying is that one can also naturally bring partiality in the picture by insisting that trees should have unique library. If one insists on unique labeling, if a label is occurring in both S and T, we get partial PDRM and PPRM from respective examples. Again, of course, one needs to verify that bifunctionality laws hold, but it's not particularly surprising. And as we were talking about, let me just repeat once again that one can generalize this still further if one does not insist on this rather artificial, I would even say, quotienting modulo commutativity. Then we would obtain here an example of something which should be called GBI, generalized quantification. Structure. Or a model for, well, we still did not say how we model connectives, but this is what I hopefully going to do today. But this would be a model of GBI logic. But as we were talking about monoids, let us have one more example, and I promise it's the last one. Slightly simpler. As we were talking about multisets, let us consider one more slightly simpler example of multisets, multiset based structure, this time understood as so called Petri net markings. Again, we have a set of locations. And a subset of natural numbers. And then our Petri net markings will be just like in the heap model, partial functions. Finite partial functions from L to K. Notice that when I have to define how the monoid operation here. So we define H1 plus H2 on L as H1 on L plus H2 on L if H1 L plus H2 L belongs to our K and it's undefined otherwise. So if the K itself is the set of all integer the set of all natural numbers, the set has multisets, multisets in L. So in fact, this would fall then even for, well, not quite, depends how one defines natural example or mathematical structures in example zero, but this would be just a monoid. Okay, so we have already quite a few structures, types of monoids or models to choose from. And now, finally, I should start defining syntax of, interpretation of syntax of our BI formulas in this strange beast. I think that I'm going first to define some other than start with the definition of valuation and this forcing style definition of satisfaction as we used to do before, after I try to play around a bit with soundness proof and try to find how to present it best, I will go for a slightly different. So I will first define several operations on the set of upward closed subset of our PPRF. So in order to define semantic clauses for BI connectives, consider first the following operations. On the set of upward closed subsets of our M of our monoid, where M is an arbitrary PPRF. It's clear what being upward closed means, right? We have defined it already when we were talking about semantics of intuitionistic formulas. So now we, in any PPRM, we have this order, which is particularly easy to deal with when we're talking about TDRMs or TPRMs. But our definition will work for marginal intuitionistic setup and for the classical setup too. Well, so this is a statement that our definitions will work, or maybe some of you are still writing, maybe I will erase this. I'm already claiming what needs to be proved as a lemma after I give you the definitions in question, that those definitions are indeed turning, the operations I'm going to define are turning an upward closed subset into upward closed subset. So let X and Y be upward closed subset of our monoid. These guys are obvious. This is just satirical operations. We have already convinced ourselves in the intuitionistic setup that interception and sum of upward closed sets is still upward closed. As discussed in the intuitionistic part. And this will be intuitionistic. So this would be the set of all those M in M's, in our M, such that for every M prime, which is above M, M prime belonging to X means that M prime belongs to Y. This is really the definition, intuitionistic definition of implication on upward closed sets. Do we still remember this? Or not quite? So these are things that we have, that we already remember from the definition of Kripke semantics for intuitionistic logic. Now we have some new operations that we can model from using the additional monoidal structure that we have on our monoids. So we can first of all form a spatial conjunction or fusion of two upward closed subsets. How do we define it? Is the set of all those M's such that there exists, well, let's write now X. X in X, Y in Y, such that X times Y is defined and X times Y is below our M. Exercise, not terribly difficult, of course. Proof. Well, the way I'm putting those definitions is that I only care that they are upward closed if those two guys are, but actually one could even probably prove something more general, namely that regardless of what this X and Y were, this thing will be upward closed. But the question whether X and Y themselves are upward closed will be slightly, very, very moderately more relevant in the next clause, because assuming that X and Y are upward closed, we can give slightly simpler definition for this for this thing. So this is the set of all those M's in M, such that for every X in X, if X times M is defined at all, then X times M belongs to Y. So here I'm not mentioning the order at all. And probably here, in order to prove that something defined in this way is upward closed, we need to use both the fact that X and Y are upward closed and this condition of bifunctionality that we have. Using bifunctionality. Good. So with this, it will be very, very simple to give definitions of the definition, semantic clauses for all the connectives that we had. But it would be useful to prove a few additional little lemmas. Which I give as exercise again. They will come immensely in handy when proving soundness. This, of course, for any x, y, z upward closed subsets of n. Similarly, this, similarly, x times is contained in y, and the same along in the additive version. Is there something else that I don't know? No, probably not. And now finally we can return to our PI formulas. And we can now define what evaluation in PP and N is. What was the notation for set of propositional variables? Did we write apt for atoms, just atoms, or whatever? Or prop for propositional variables?
Apt for atoms.
Yeah. So, given PPRM M, define M valuation as a function from the set of A times 2. As you can easily guess by now, the set of upward closed subset of M. And then we say that the notation of an atom is simply V of A. And as you can easily imagine, we will now use operations defined before to define the notations of formulas. But of course, bottom will be empty set, top will be a Holoff monoid unit. Ah, this is an interesting thing that we have not defined yet. It will be trivial to say what it is if it is a discrete monoid. Otherwise, we have to say that this is the set of all those M's which are above unit of the monoid. So the smallest upper closed set containing the monoid unit. And now for all the formulas, for all the connectives, we follow the obvious route. So and so on, and so on, and so on. Maybe I will be a bit lazy, although this is a bit messily erased here, so maybe it won't be very readable. And implication and also linear regression. I mean, if you're not as lazy as I am, then simply write all these things explicitly. So this times this, and the evaluation V is the denotation of the first formula times, and so on. And just to keep in line with the notation that we used to use, let us write that. Let's say clearly that I'm finding a notation here. M, P, M forces. Ah, no, I didn't want to use forcing notation. Satisfies phi, which is read as M belongs to the denotation of phi under our evaluation. In the monoid, it is basically dropped off from this notation. Right, but there is quite some bureaucracy to be done before we start formulating and proving our soundness lemma. So first of all, we have to define not only satisfaction or denotation of a formula, but we also have to give these definitions for a bunch. So yet another piece of notation that we are going to have, well, this is actually a definition. This will be simply the denotation of propositional collapse of a bunch that I introduced the last time. And again, we could introduce the same notation for a whole bunch being satisfied at a given point. But bunches have holes, which can be filled in, and well, there would be several ways how to go about it. I propose the following one. So this should be understood not as a bunch with a hole, but just an ordinary bunch. Now, given given, of course, a bunch with a hole, which is filled with concrete argument, we could define its notation using simply this clause. But how would one go about defining the notation of bunches as bunches with holes, having arguments that still need to be completed? The natural way that I see is to say that given given such a bunch with a hole and a monoid, a PPRM with valuation, define a function determined by this bunch with a hole from the upward closed subsets of this monoid, so operation on the upward closed subset of the monoid as follows. Pick a propositional variable, an atom A. Well, actually, I would prefer really to write here a meta variable P to stress that this is something that can be always changed up to alpha renaming. Not occurring in gamma. Define now valuation V with X set to with A set to X as V of B wherever on B wherever B is distinct from A, and simply X otherwise. Well, strictly speaking, from the point of view of any formula occurring in the bunch, we don't have to worry at all about variables which valuations of variables which are not occurring therein. This is something that being very pedantic, we should still prove, of course. And then we can define finally a denotation of rather, first, before I define the notation of bunch with a hole filled in, let us define the notation of bunch itself understood as, or bunch with a hole understood as an operation of upward closed sets, as the notation which we already gave for a concrete bunch under this value. So bunches with holes should be understood as operators on the collection of upward closed subsets of our monoids rather than concrete subsets themselves. And now we can state several useful lemmas. Well, actually, before we start stating those lemmas, there might be some leftover syntactic observations about bunches in our sequent calculus that I did not state last time, I'm not sure. Yes? What are the lemmas that I will need for the proof of the lemma that I want to state right now? So, purely syntactic lemma that we probably did not say last time is that if gamma is congruent to delta, then we have that all these sequences that have happened. Now, did I said it last time? Was there a demo of this effect? I remember that there were quite a few syntactic lemmas that I wanted to have. The second, which is again purely syntactic, is that if you have that gamma with the whole feeding with delta in the probably entire sky, then gamma with a whole feeding with propositional collapse of delta does the same thing, and all the other way around. The other direction, of course, would be quite. This is just induction using introduction rules for conjunction, the additive and multiplicative conjunctions. Here we are using cut. Induction using left clauses for additive and multiplicative conjunction. And super trivial one, which I should probably say like as close zero, is that, but this is something that we are going to use over and over. This is actually why I wanted to make sure that I stated all the syntactic lemmas from the last time, is that the propositional collapse of a bunch which was obtained by filling in the whole in gamma with the propositional collapse of delta, maybe I will write square brackets here, is the same thing as the propositional collapse of this. So these are the syntactic lemmas that I was missing, but this is of course completely independent from this part. And just to return to our syntax, our semantic clauses, and state the last three missing facts that I need for the sadness lemma, which are consequences of this definition of semantics of bunches with whole. Again, I'm not giving a proof, but only because the proof of something like this is a trivial application of induction that you, of course, should be able to do anyway. So the last lemma, which is actually slightly more fun than this purely syntactic one, would be stating basic properties of those functions. Monotonicity. The second, I can say this. This is something that I want to call stability. And this simply means that, so here we had quantification over any x, y in upper closed cells. And here for any BI formula, phi, we will have that in putting that the notation of this formula under our evaluation, one should be slightly careful here. As I said, here when one is applying this bunch to a concrete bunch will fall to a concrete formula, then one wants to pick up A, which is not appearing not only in the bunch itself but also in the formula in question. But it could be done more cleanly, but it would involve more unnecessary overhead and time that we don't have. So this thing should be equal to this, which, as you recall, is simply propositional collapse of this whole bunch under our evaluation. And the third fact, which will be also very useful, is that this function distributes over sum. And this is much less trivial than you may think. So as a corollary of this, of course, we get that but this will be trivial consequence of 2 and 3. Question, would that hold if I replace this sum here with intersection, so it's this junction here with conjunction? How trivial is this? And what does the distribution of this over conjunctions, respectively, this junction actually mean? Also, what would happen if I could replace additive conjunction, so if I replace the sum or the conjunction here with the multiplicative conjunction, usual specialty. Would this thing still hold? Well, that's something to think. Do we need to leave now? I have to be finishing in 4 minutes or so right now, so let me give me at least a chance to state the lemma for which we were building throughout this whole session. So we say that leave it as a question. Can I replace this or and finally, the most important definition and the statement of the theorem that we were really heading towards throughout this lecture. So the definition that we wanted to have is that a sequence is valid in a given monoid under given valuation if you guessed it. And then we have soundness theorem. For any gamma and phi. The fact that you can derive our sequent in our BI calculus implies then for any monoid and any evaluation we need, we had this ones. This will be often abbreviated as this bunch semantically entails our formula phi. Well, we need to decide now on the right proportion which part of this theorem will be left for you to fill in as simply at home, which clauses we will do more or less unwillingly next time, and which will be delegated to the last plot that we still need to pose. So, to be continued tomorrow in any case, and then of course we also want to see what kind, if we have any chance of having a completeness result, not just soundness. But this we'll discuss tomorrow in the next week.